Hello and welcome to another episode of the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast Blindside Edition. And after much clamouring on social media, we've managed to make it happen. We've got one of the best referees in the world and we're going to examine him. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome to the podcast Mr. Luke Pearce. Hello, Luke. First and foremost, how are you? Excited about the rugby that is on offer in November? No doubt.
Good morning, fellas. Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't feel like it was yesterday that we were finishing the rugby championship and flying down south and we're back up north. We've had 6 weeks of premiership, which seems to have gone in the blink of an eye. And now we get which is really refreshing, maybe for the first time, I think, where everyone can just focus on the Autumn Internationals, where there's no other kind of elite level, obviously the Premiership Cup. But outside of that, there's no external kind of rugby to focus on, which is brilliant because I think it creates that more drama, creates the attention, the focus on what should be the best teams in the world clashing against each other. And week after week, you know, different to July because we get different games every week rather than the same teams playing each other, which we shall see kind of unfolds in the next 3 weeks.
We didn't bring you on to talk about this, but can I just dive into something there because you alluded to it? There's a lot of focus on rugby players, on the amount of rugby that's being played and the amount of output that they're having to do. I can't think of anything more difficult mentally than trying to referee a top flight game of rugby. You alluded to it there. It is week after week after week for you guys. And I'm not looking to conjure up sympathy. We're not going to get it for referees, but is it tough? How are you managing that load, as it were, that's coming your way? Because it must be a lot. A factor in the travel, you've mentioned it there, factor in getting to everywhere, doing what you're doing. Is it tough? Is it tougher than it used to be?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I've been doing this job for 15 years now. It makes me feel slightly older than I used to be when I first started it. Attempted to grow facial hair, but nowhere near Sam's level. But I'm sticking with it. It has changed. And I think it's just adaptation. And like every walk of life, you just got to change with it. We've got pretty good bosses at the RFU that look after us in terms of our workload in the Premiership. You know, for example, the first 6 weeks, I don't think any of us refereed all six. I think I refereed four, run touch in one or run touch in two. And that alleviates that kind of pressure a bit because you can build up for maybe a 2 or 3 week block. And then you can ease up a little bit to run touch and you build back up again. So if it's one thing I've learned over the years, it's just trying to taper off. You can't perform. And I'm sure a lot of people would say I've never peaked at performance anyway, but you can't perform at your ultimate and at your best all the time. It's just impossible. So it's just trying to work up and work down and factor in travel. I mean, factor in kids' time, you know, trying to spend time with the kids who are at school normally. This week's half term, which is proven a bit chaotic, but it's getting that balance right. And I think if you're happy in those circumstances, everything else kind of takes precedent. There's nothing worse than when you're leaving stressed and wondering what they're going to do, what time they're being picked up, where they're going and everything else. It makes everything a bit more stressful. But the great thing with November for us Northern Hemisphere fellas and girls is that we're all up north and everything's within a 2-hour flight away, which is a big difference when you're flying home and you're back after 2 or 3 nights rather than a 2 or 3 week breakaway, which is a nice kind of change from that rugby championship environment. Different, but a nice change.
We'll talk about where you're going and the matches that you'll be involved with. Can I also talk, and I was lucky enough to spend some time with Carl Dixon recently. I asked him exactly the same question, which is how kind are you to yourself? Because us as fans really do, you know, look at a referee's performance and want the performance of a referee to be a certain caliber. I know that is nothing compared to what the pressure that you guys put on yourselves. How do you run through a process of of reviewing yourself and recognizing that you can't just stand there and pick it apart, because you could, because it's like an imperfect art in a way. Every single breakdown, you could probably blow your whistle at something or somewhere. How do you, as a top flight referee, look after the conversations you have with yourself?
I had a conversation actually with someone a few days ago about refereeing rugby and how it's different to other sports, because we're in danger, I think, in our current job of possibly wanting to create robots. And if we create robots in rugby, the sport, I think, will be a very boring and won't be entertaining at all, because all we can do is just, as you say, Sam, referee a law book and put out the laws wherever we want to. One thing that I tend to do, and again, it comes with a bit more experience, I come off the pitch, and when I'm traveling home the next couple of days, is did I referee that game as I needed to? Did that game get what it needed? And what I mean by that is, you know, if I only blew, I did Sale and Gloucester 3 weeks ago, it was 9 penalties in the whole game. Nice, entertaining game, 2 attacking teams. Did that fit the bill for those 2 teams? Yeah, I think it did. One team got a winning bonus point. Gloucester got 2 losing bonus points. They lost, but they got 2 points. Was the boat rocked at all by anything I didn't do? No. Okay, so that's a good starting point. Now, that won't be the same in games where, when I went to Newcastle Exeter, where I'm doing, for obvious reasons, of 9-10 in the league, both chasing that all-important win. If I only blew 9 penalties in that game, that wouldn't be right for that match, because it was so much more aggressive at the breakdown. Every point was critical in terms of just winning the game. Bonus points were irrelevant to a certain extent. It was just the win. So I left Kingston Park having blown 28, 29 penalties. And I did what needed to fit that game. And I think that's where I often look back and go, right, was that a good game of rugby? And people have got varying kind of degrees of what they see as a good game of rugby. Some love a 9-8 scrum fest line out in the pouring rain. Some love a 54-48. And I can see the attraction to both. But did the ref, And I, when I watch games, does that referee, and did I, when I'm refereeing it, give what was needed for that 80 minutes? And if it's yes, great, good starting point. Now pick apart, did we get, you know, if we gave 2 yellows in that one game, in that context, that could be correct. In a different game, it might be 2 reds, and that wouldn't be wrong either. But it's just trying to decipher, was that game, did that performance fit the bill for that match? Now then, what's my next game? Okay. Will that performance, no, I need to tweak that, because this game will be a different kind of game plan from both teams. There's different external pressures, and all this kind of goes into the melting pot. So that's often, and that's even before we get told what's right or wrong. We've been there before, Sam. The systems that we use in terms of analyzing, and green, reds, oranges, ticks, crosses. And that's before everyone at home has their view on social media. Like, whenever I watch a game, is do I follow that decision? Yeah, I can follow that. Doesn't mean it's right or wrong, but does it make it understandable? And I think that's where we still got to drive refereeing towards, is we don't want to create robots. If we do create robots, I think we'll have more people turning off our sport than turning on.
That's a concern that I have. Baseball, obviously, the World Series concluded last night. They have that they're talking about bringing robotic umpires who can call the balls and strikes and make them absolutely perfect. But it then loses a nuance, because there's people who've learned how to catch the ball in a certain way that makes it look like a strike, or batters who can make it look like a ball and all these kind of things. And you feel like there's a nuance there. And rugby feels the same, in that there could potentially, with some kind of technology, make perfect calls. But I think, as you've mentioned previously, and as I think people are understanding, if we referee the law book, there wouldn't be a game. There's so few things that happen in a game that would be completely legal. And so you do need that human element of understanding and going, oh, hang on, let's let that go. And I'm now going to be consistent for the rest of the game and kind of let that stuff go.
Yeah, we have play the laws. We say don't play the laws, play the referee. And that's been something that's been said to me since I was 7 years old running around. You know, to a certain extent, we will lose that, won't we, Luke?
We have to keep the grey in the game. I don't want to be part of a sport which becomes so black and white, it's sterile. We've got a lot of challenges. Let's call a spade, you know, with this 20-minute red card trial, with head contact, with trying to speed the game up. We're trying to make it commercially as commercially viable as possible, whilst keeping the fabric part of the sport, which those two don't always come hand in hand. Also having the awareness that we have to grow the sport. We've got to get it bigger. We've got to get more money in the door, more bums on seats, more kids playing at the bottom end to rise with that pyramid. How that all comes into the melting pot is a challenge for people paid a fair bit more money than I am. But it's certainly something that we're not naive to in terms of refereeing it, because if we go out there and let's face it, referees could ruin a game. You could ruin a game if you really wanted to blow your whistle every 60 seconds, you could. And that's not the intention or nor the reason why anybody would want to do it. And that's what we've got to try and get across to players, coaches, supporters, other refs, our management. Sometimes the best decision is when we decide not to make a decision. And we do that way more than the times we blow to decide we do make a decision. It's just very hard to kind of make those material or show them when we're not making a decision, if that comes across in any non-technical way.
Yeah, no, it does. And it's so always great speaking to you, Luke, because you kind of reassert my faith in that idea and in that process. Where are you this November? Where might you pop up on the screen? I appreciate referees never want to pop up on the screen. I get that. I get you don't want to be seen, but where might we spy you this autumn?
So we spoke about kind of like those building up and building down. So I've had a building down phase the last couple of weeks. I was my last refereeing game was at Newcastle Exeter, as I said. I ran touch at Stanley Park on Sunday. And then I'm fourth official at England this weekend for England, New Zealand. Run touch in Scotland 2 weeks on the bounce. And then referee in Paris for France, Argentina. So I've tapered my kind of time off. And I can now slowly build it back up. We've got a conference at the Lensbury next week with all the world rugby referees, where we're going to go over kind of every window. There's four windows, as you'll be aware. The Six Nations, July Tour, Rugby Championship and November. We just try and make sure that we're all on that same page. A very tricky thing to do, because not all games are the same. You know, you take some of the games from the summer were very, very different to each other. You know, Ireland, South Africa, which Carl and I were lucky enough to be involved in, were really, really hard test matches. 1v2 in the world, brutal. And every time we blew a whistle, we were critically analysed, as we rightly should be for a game of that calibre. You then had other games. New Zealand played Fiji and won by 50 points in Los Angeles in a bit of an exhibition game. You know, so we were all these different kind of rugby's coming together. And we've got to make sure that when we meet next week, we've just got some key kind of critical few areas that we all sign up to and go, yeah, we can deliver that. We think we can deliver that. That's what we measured against, and acknowledge that mistakes will be made, that it won't be perfect, but with the aim that we get those big moments right. And people can expand on big moments as much as they want to. Big moments being the cards, the tries, and any massive talking points. If we can sell them well, explain them well, be right in law when we need to be. You know, there are, as we mentioned before we started recording, those little law nuances that people won't understand, and I probably don't understand, having done it for a long time. When it comes down to law, we got very little wiggle room to be wrong. And that's where we just got to make sure that we're all on the same page. So we'll get together next week. We'll have a beer or two on Sunday evening before cracking on Monday morning with some in-depth work, with the aim of getting to the end of November with the kind of end of feeling that the Rugby Championship had, and I think the first 6 weeks in the Premiership have had. Bear with me, I don't watch a great deal of the URC just because of travel. We try to, but it seems that, and maybe I'm cursing it too soon, that we've turned the tide in terms of people talking about the games, scores, teams, and less so on the referees and TMOs. That's certainly how it felt leaving the Rugby Championship, certainly how it felt in the first six rounds of the Premiership. And I'm not naive enough to know that partly a lot of that is because the score lines are blowouts. You know, if you get 30 points to 10s, if the referee is the talking point in a 30 point to 10 game, we've probably got a bit of an issue with the performance, or someone's not being very true. November will bring a different test, because I think with the terms of the weather, with the terms of the teams are playing, Southern Hemisphere teams at the end of their season, us at the kind of relative beginning, it makes those levels of competition, let alone the pressures on teams, you know, the external pressures of wanting to win or needing to win. And I read an article this morning in one of the teams saying that they now must win. They now must get victories. Well, there's pressure straight away. So, yeah, it's an exciting time ahead of November, really.
We pride ourselves on this podcast on just lifting a lid on things that people don't know. I think I kind of know what a referee does. I think I kind of know what an AR does. I haven't a clue what a fourth official does. Tell us what you're going to be doing. What's your role as fourth official at Twickenham this weekend?
So every union put a fourth official as a kind of host official to help. Like Angus is refereeing. So Angus Gardner and I go back years. So I'll be going up Friday morning, catching up with him, carrying his kit bag, making sure he's got everything he needs in terms of any help or, you know, the boys and girls come in from around the world. Sometimes if you've been in the job a while, you've got a lot of contacts. If you're new into it, a bit different. And then in terms of just being the replacement official, which is the boring part, because you're basically the shouting post for emotions and feelings to be taken out in a mostly respectful way, I must add. And then just making sure that all the boring regs, all the boring regulations that no one will see until it goes wrong. And when it does go wrong, it normally gets into the press because it's a big moment, you know, whether an uncontested scrum should have been uncontested or not. Those little boring bits and pieces, which, you know, it's the dullest job until you get something wrong. And then you realize that, you know, something has gone catastrophically wrong in terms of rugby. And I say catastrophic, it's only a game of rugby at the end of the day, but. So that's the normal role. And then we try and share that round between the guys and girls internally and giving people experiences. And yeah, it's a very special place to go. And you don't get many chances as anybody to be in the same stadium watching England be the All Blacks. I think it's every 2 or 3 years they play. So yeah, it'll be another special occasion without that extra burden of pressure or stress. And I can sit and watch the haka, or I can watch the anthems and actually enjoy it rather than worrying about what I'm going to do at the first whistle.
Yeah, I like that.
We spoke, you mentioned there, Luke, about the feedback to use a kind of a balanced word that referees get. My, and I can only say this is fairly recent. This is probably the last 4 or 5 years, but my take is I don't talk about referees. I love to talk about the laws, but on social media, I don't talk about referees, partly because as an analyst, if you went into a club and said, don't worry, lads, we were perfect, but we was robbed on Saturday, you would get laughed out there because, you know, the players aren't interested in that. I just did some maths. Referees are 3% of the game if you consider, you know, one of 31 players on the pitch. But the conversation around referees, even at the start of the season, is maybe 30%, 40%, 50% sometimes. Does that get frustrating as a referee? You said earlier that you appreciate that you will be the focus. Does that get frustrating, especially when you hear pundits get it wrong, as I've heard a few times this season? They've made the wrong calls and then the horse is horse's bolted the stable on social media, then, and you're deemed to make a mistake even though you actually haven't. Is that frustrating?
Yeah, and it used to frustrate me far more than it does now. Again, it's amazing in any walk of life, isn't it? The more experienced you become, you get a bit more, you get a few more stripes. And you kind of, you get to understand that if I go out to France and Argentina and make a howling error and it's a 19 points to 18 game and that match winning penalty is wrong, then I open all the doors up in the world to be criticised. And, you know, probably rightly so, because I shouldn't be making those errors that contributes to that final decision. So we've got to be grown up enough to accept when we get something wrong, we're going to get the heat. That's the job. Where we can't accept everything, and we see it, you know, I'll be very open in the Premiership. Sometimes the club's feedback, and most of it's positive. Sometimes when a team lose and they send in, you know, 8 to 10, 12 clips. Well, if we wanted to play tit for tat, and of course we don't, but if we wanted to, we could easily send 8 to 12 clips of teams dropping the ball, of kicks being missed, of set plays going wrong. We don't do that. We can't do that because we're not in that kind of environment. But and I think that's one thing that we got to just take a balanced view, that if it's over the course of a game, we're going to make mistakes. That's the given, like players drop the ball. It's not always the referee's fault when a team lose. And I think that's where we've just got to get back to. And I think we've made a lot of ground, but, you know, over recent years, there's no point avoiding the subject, you know, since Nick Berry went through hell after that video of the Lions test. We had different experiences of referees being the kind of focal point. I think 2023 World Cup was a decent line in the sand. I think that social media effect, I'd like to say it's been reduced. I know personally it's almost null and void now. You know, most whether the system that we're using to get rid of some of the comments is working really well, or people are just learning that actually it's not always the ref's fault, and it's not always, and we're just part of the game. But like I said at the start, we can't be naive. If we make a howling mistake or we miss something that's really clear, we deserve the criticism that comes with that. The same as if a kicker has a kick in front of the sticks on 82 minutes to win the game for his team and he misses it or she misses it, then they deserve a bit of heat as well, because that's what happens in sport, you know. And it's a fine line, isn't it? Because we've got to be grown up enough and big enough and ugly enough that we're working in a sport in front of 82,000 people, millions watching on TV. And if we make mistakes, you hold your hand up. And with the backing and hopefully the backing that we've got, especially at World Rugby level, that's not your career gone. You know, it's not a gun to your head, make one big mistake and you're out of there. I think times have changed now. World Cups are slightly different because of the magnified kind of attitude towards that tournament. But if referees make a mistake, it doesn't make them a dreadful referee. Now, if I go make the same mistake every window, every game,
yeah,
I deserve to be dropped, deserve to be gone. But same as players, if they have one bad game, doesn't make a player a bad player. Now, if they have 10 bad games consecutively, they may be struggling for selection. So they've got to go back to the drawing board. And that's hopefully where we're getting to with refereeing now, rather than just one hit wonders, one game in. How was the game? Yeah, it went well. Cool. You're still in. Did it go well? No, it didn't go well. Ooh, you're struggling. And that's where we've got to get away from.
Yeah, let's head into questions, because there are some fascinating ones to have, and I think we'll have some amusement here trying to get it. One pretty serious one, and I think you might have an opinion on this, and I think everyone has an opinion on it. It's about time being stopped. Kwai Chang on Twitter, Paddle N Jones 1. These Twitter names are always interesting. It says, what do you think about stopping the clock after a scrum call when the ball is back in play after the 70-minute mark? So this is quite a nuanced question. So after, you know, with 10 minutes left in the game, should we be saving every single second for ball in play? I saw an interesting thing recently on ball in play in other sports. We're tough on it in rugby. It seems to be a stat which comes out quite a lot. And there are other sports where it isn't prevalent, where the ball is in play far less, and yet they don't seem to complain about it. Luke, just briefly, ball in play, is there still work to be done around the laws with ball in play time?
Yeah, look, I'm sat here with my 5-year-old daughter posing questionly and looking at me eating a cheese sandwich. I think yes, the short answer to the question, absolutely. I don't think we should be having 80 minutes where the ball is in average of play 30 odd minutes. I think that's a poor spectator product and doesn't really justify the money that people are hard working money to spend on a ticket to watch half an hour of a product when you're there for 80 minutes of the game. Does that make it the be all and end all? No. And I think, as you say, Sam, a lot of the focus is on ball in play being the biggest hit. The irony is you can have a belting game, 58. Sorry, my other daughter shouting there.
Go for it. Don't worry.
You can have a belter of a game, 54, 53. But because of a conversion can now take 60 seconds, you could end up having half an hour knocked out of a game because tries are scored. It doesn't make it a bad game. So that's where I say ball in play is not the be all and end all. Where we've got to do a boatload of work, and I'm quite passionate about this internally in our premiership, and hopefully that will come through slowly but surely, is where we stop the game and for reasons why. I'm a big advocate at the moment and I had a good chat with Alex Sanderson at Sale, because perhaps I pushed it a bit too far at Sale v Gloucester. I want to stop the game for one of four reasons now. First one is being head knocks. If a doctor is on to check a player, we have to stop. No ifs, no buts, the game stops. Number two is a serious injury. Clearly, we all understand if someone is really struggling, we should stop the game. Absolutely. Number three is if it's a front row. So if it's a front row player and we're required in the scrum, then we need to stop the game. And the fourth reason is if a player is in risk. So if he's in the area where we're about to play, then we need to stop it. Anything outside of that, I don't really understand why we're stopping the game. So you take, for example, when we got a line out, why are we saying that only the hooker can throw the ball in? You know, South Africa got Cheslin Kolbe. Ireland had Van der Fleer, who was throwing the ball in at Scotland 2 years ago. We stopped the game to allow players to get back to their feet. We stopped the game for a bit of cramp in the backfield. that's where I think we can add to the sport. And I think that's where we can make tweaks and changes, because we're not trying to kind of penalize teams whose players are down getting treatment, but there's nothing stopping making a substitute. There's nothing stopping a physio taking a player to the touchline to get treatment to allow that game to continue, rather than dropping them in the field of play, dropping them wherever the lineout's about to happen, which, let's face it, we see all the time. Players will trot to a lineout, go down to a knee and ask to get treatment. And that's because we kind of grown that culture, I think. That's where we can make a big difference and where we can drive sport to open up. What that will bring, I think, and I'm sure defence coaches will have the complete opposite argument, that will create holes in defences, because at times you'll have 14v15. It might encourage players to get up off their backside a bit quicker and get back into the game. And if they do require a change and they do require, and they're genuinely injured, well, then substitute them. And I think that's where we can kind of make a bit of a difference to this entertainment factor and stoppages and needless stoppages. For one of those four reasons I said, it's understandable. We totally get it. I don't think those four reasons happen as often as what we're stopping the game at the moment. And that's an observation I make. And that does put a bit of heat on us, puts a bit of pressure on us as refs in the middle, because we're saying, no, is it a head knock? No. Is it serious? No, it's cramp. Right, come on, up we go, let's go. And I think that's, if we did that, I think people would actually respect that element of trying to speed the game up, rather than bringing in maybe new laws which have consequences factors. For example, use it after 5 seconds. That's great. 5 seconds is still quite long in my view. What's the penalty for that? At the moment, it's a turnover scrum. A scrum can take, it's meant to take 30 seconds. It probably takes, and Sam, you know better than I do, probably 40, 45 seconds if that ball comes back into play. So automatically, we've lost a minute simply because we're trying to speed the game up, which goes against probably the reasons why we're trying to do something. And those unintended consequences of law adaptations and law changes can't always be thought out originally, because no one knows the next level. You know, there's always something next happening in rugby. As long as we're kind of grown up enough and mature enough in our sport, sometimes to go fall back on our sword and go, yep, tried that, didn't quite work, now we're reverting to this, without changing the fabric and changing everything every season, which is a danger in my view.
Yeah. Come on then, Sam Lana. Sam's been working on some scenarios. He's going to give them to you, Luke. I want you to kind of think about it and make a pretty good decision. I mean, Sam Lana has worked very hard on these. They're very, very strange. Okay, so ready, Sam? You're in position.
I am.
Here we go.
I've actually done this to Luke before. For the
do you need a pen, Sam?
I think a pen might be helpful. Yeah, I've worked on explaining these as simply as I can.
Go on then.
You might be familiar, Luke, with the Ask the Umpire on TMS. It's always the best. Bit. So, scenario number one. Let's say it's England New Zealand this weekend. George Ford is in his half, as are England at the ruck. Passes the ball back. George Ford hoofs it forward. It hits Joe Marler on the arse, who is in New Zealand's half. It then bounces back to George Ford, who kicks it again. And it bounces, goes into touch in New Zealand's 22. Is that a 50-22?
And just to create, Joe Marler was in front of George Ford originally when he kicked it.
He was in front of him and in New Zealand's half.
Okay, so technically, by law, it would be a scrum where the ball hit Joe Marler's backside, because it's hit the player in front of where he kicked it, accidentally, obviously, unless he's deliberately put his backside in front, which would be unlikely. So in law, again, and this is where I find it rugby fascinating, it's the boring part of me. It should be a scrum because in law it says scrum. If it had no idea, and this is the Exeter Saracens, and it hits the player in the thirds and it bounces back, the referee might go, do you know what? Let's crack on. Let's get on with it. Now, would it be a 50-22? No, because his own team's players, backsiders, bring the ball back into the half. So no, it wouldn't be. And also, I even say, so let's break these answers into two, Sam. England v New Zealand this weekend, it should be a scrum where it's his backside. No ifs, no buts. That's the law. Pretty important at the very, very top end of that pyramid of the referee, the law, when we need to. With scope further down the pyramid and the other games where we have that ability as a ref to say, nah, that's an accident. But you can't have the best of both, mate. You've hit your mate. That should be a scrum. I've let you play through it. You can't expect the ball at the 22. And I think fairness is a big thing in refereeing. I think fairness the equity is the posh word, isn't it? I think fairness is the ultimate goal of reffing at any level. If you can be fair, and when you blow your whistle because it's not fair, then I don't think you can go too far wrong. Yeah, next question.
Answer. Perfect. Brilliant. That's answer. as perfect answer. Okay, next question. This is a couple of years ago. This is not a true scenario, but it's Ken Owings and Lee Halfpenny. The ball is hoofed up in the air. The clock's gone dead. Lee Halfpenny realizes that if he catches this ball, he will be outside the 22 because it's going to fall just outside the 22. And he thinks, hang on, if we call a mark here, we can just kick it to touch and win the game. So he asks Ken Owings to lift him. Ken Owings is stood entirely in the 22. He lifts Lee Halfpenny. Lee Halfpenny catches the ball entirely outside of the 22 and calls a mark. What do you do?
Firstly, I'd say I'd love to see Ken Owings playing back for Wales because he's one of the best characters to ref and to play with, as was Lee.
He's buying time. He's buying time here. Carry on.
Again, does that seem fair? No. It doesn't seem fair that you can elongate, if that's the right word, the area of a game or area of the field. I take it back to a law which I did see in play years ago, and Sam, you'll probably remember better than I do. A team tried to prevent a penalty kick going over the posts by lifting players to block the ball. And I think I'd use the same logic in this example and say, no, you're outside. You can't use your mate to kind of make it 23, 24 meters because the areas are 22. So I'd say no. And I'd look forward to Lee catching the ball and stood there still and waiting to get demolished by an opponent.
So would it be play on? It would be play on.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I tell you another example on where we in rugby, and especially refereeing, I did Australia, South Africa back in August, and there was a kick go through. The kick was touched in the air by an opponent, and it went, sorry, so South Africa kicked the ball. It's touched off an Australian hand. The ball goes through, and the Australian fullback goes to catch the ball, calls mark, but momentarily spills it. Okay, so in law, it should be play on. I'm wrong to call a mark. But what was the smartest decision for me in that game? And I'm sure all South African fans would disagree, but they were winning 30-3 at this time. So you get a bit more scope for management as a referee. I called a mark because everybody stopped. If I played on, I wouldn't be wrong. However, I'd have to explain why in law I'm correct. Do you remember Wales v Australia? With Mike Adamson as referee, Dave Rennie was the Australian coach. The Welsh guy went to make a intercept. It looks for everyone like a deliberate knock-on. The ball goes backwards. The Welsh centre went and scored a try. Everyone in the game has stopped looking at the poor ref. Mike just said, sorry, lads, it's gone backwards. I can't do anything about it. Now, if he blew his whistle there and just either blew a knock-on or a deliberate knock-on, I don't think many people would have argued it because it looked like a decision rather than being the accurate decision. And that's always amazes me in rugby, especially refereeing, where we have a decision which looks right, everyone gets it, but actually might be wrong. And you go back to the World Cup last year, Ben O'Keefe in the semi-final, France, South Africa with Evan Etzebeth, the ball goes backwards. He's absolutely right, I think, by the way. So in my view, others may disagree, but it's an accurate decision. If he blew his whistle and it gave a different outcome, I think a lot of people would also follow that because it looks like a deliberate knock-on. So I think that's where we're in this kind of transition in our sport of making accurate calls from a law book versus understandable and followable ones.
I guess it's interesting that situation because if Lee's waiting there to be hit, he thinks he's called the mark, and you go, actually, hang on, everyone thinks this is a mark. The only way to restart would be a scrum, but the clock's dead anyway, so it's he's achieved what he wanted to achieve, even by perhaps not the means he expected.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Ask this last one because, Luke, you were talking before we press record about a scenario. So ask this last one because it might lead you, Luke, to talk about something that did actually happen. But this is a good question. Go on then, Sam.
Yeah, okay. So Scotland, let's say they're playing against Fiji. They kick the ball through it looks like it's going to go into Fiji's dead ball area. And then it looks like it might go past. The Fijian fullback has got plenty of time. He goes to touch the ball down, so it will be a goal line dropout, but misses and slides through the dead ball area, so he's now out the back of play. The Scottish players are all warming up. They're all off the pitch, but they form a wall, so he now can't get back onto play. Everyone's entirely off the pitch. And in doing so, the Scottish player runs down, touches the ball for the try. What is the outcome?
Firstly, I hope it never happens to me, because it'd be a tough sell, especially if against the home team. I think I revert this back to an actual real-life example. The World Cup last year, Italy played Uruguay, I think it was, down in Nice, for memory. And I think the Italian team kicked the ball through and it hit someone warming up, hit a Uruguayan player, minding his own business, warming up. Just one of those freak accidents that never should happen, but did happen. And in law, which I learned pretty sharply afterwards, that we should, in that example, give what we think would happen next. So take the back to your Scotland-Fiji example. If we think that the Fijian player who missed it first time, but would have actually got back to ground that ball if it weren't for the actions of the players warming up, then we should give what we think would happen next. I think the interesting bit is that we talk about players externally off the field. They're not out of the game. So say those players created a wall, or say a player deliberately stopped a quick lineout being taken, they can still be sanctioned. They can still be removed from the field of play if we're seeing them as cheating, I guess. And I remember down here at Exeter, Harry Williams, when Exeter played Saracens years ago with Wayne Barnes, and Harry Williams was on the subs bench. Big scrap happened. I say a big scrap as much as they do this day and age.
He entered the field of play, didn't he? Yeah.
He did. He came off the bench and got involved in the fight. And Wayne was dead right in what he did. He red carded the player and was removed. So don't see it very often. But then he became the player who was sat on the bench and was red carded for something that, and he's not even on the field of play. So that's one thing that we got to make sure that, like, we keep that element of knowledge with people, that just because you're sat on a bench, same with water carriers, same with coaches, physios. I mean, doctors are slightly different. They're there for the care of the players. They shouldn't be really, you know, anything else. They do occasionally, but that's one thing that we got to make sure we keep driving through, I think.
Can I just ask a follow-up? Just we could talk about this for days. I know we have to wrap up. But in that same situation I described, the Fijian slides out of the field of play. But this time, it's the mascot that prevents him from coming back onto the field of play. Is that just tough luck, or is that the same? Does the same principle apply?
It's what happens next. And I've still not yet in 15 years of professional rugby red carded a mascot. I'm not sure I'd want to get there. But yeah, it goes back to what you think would happen most likely, which I think is a great law, and I wish we could have it everywhere else around the park. It makes life a lot easier.
You see, we've set him off. We've set Sam Lana off. The next step is you're in Paris. A cockerel enters the field of play.
No joke.
Luke, it's been utterly brilliant, as always, speaking to you. Thank you so, so much. In many moons' time, we might ask you back with more questions once Sam Lana has had a time to think of more really weird and wonderful scenarios to put you through it. But it's always good. Good luck this autumn, Luke Pearce. We wish you all the best. And it's been another fantastic Whiteboard Rugby podcast.